God, we do thank you for the chance to gather together this evening. We pray that as we look at this subject, a subject matter that is culturally very difficult and very much in our faces at the present moment, we pray that you would help us to think about it rightly and to think about you rightly and to think about human beings rightly. And so we ask for your grace in that. We pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen. On the note sheet, you see one of the first things on there talks about some books. These are all books that I've kind of referenced as we have gone through the class. And so I'm just putting them there kind of as a works cited with a little bit of notes on them in terms of how long they are and how difficult they are to read. I'll quote from, I think, all three of the ones that are listed there at different points. But those are the books and the authors that have helped me thinking about tonight. And so just kind of want to back up and just think about kind of the progression of this class as we've walked through it. So we started with what we said were God's designs for sex. And we say that as anatomy and as activity. So what were God's designs? What are God's designs in terms of what is a man and what is a woman in terms of our sexual makeup? And then what are the designed boundaries for sexual activity in light of that sexual makeup? And so then we moved on kind of from thinking about what is man, what is woman, what is the boundaries for sexual activity. We moved on to kind of some discussion about roles of men and women, men and women. So in light of who we have been created to be, what roles has God given man and woman to fulfill? And then we examined, in particular, we examined what rebellion against those identities, rebellion against those roles look like within the male and female relationships. If you remember kind of thinking back to the drawing on the whiteboard, we saw kind of in the garden, we saw this abdication of authority, the misuse of authority, and then the sinful usurping of authority from the lowest of the creatures, starting with the serpent, up to the woman, up to the man, all the way up against the high king of heaven. And so that was kind of the bullseye. And then we're kind of working out from this bullseye in terms of different variations, different rebellions against God's design for sexuality. So kind of that first class was like, this is what God has designed sex and sexuality to look like. And then kind of we've been working out from it in these kind of different larger concentric circles of rebellion. And so kind of the next circle we moved toward was a larger rebellion against God's designs for sexuality, and that was homosexuality. So we spent time thinking about rebellion within the male and female relationship. So exchanging this male-female relationship for male and male, or female and female. And so kind of working outward. And now if you were thinking about it in terms of a picture, like kind of the furthest outer ring of this bullseye, if you will, would be the subject of transgenderism. So kind of the next level of rebellion. So whereas in homosexuality, we're talking about rebellion kind of against this design of how God's designed male and female relationships. Well, in transgenderism, this next level of rebellion is a rebellion against the created order within a person's own biological organization. Okay, so this is an attempt to edit the image of God. When we think about transgenderism, an attempt to edit the image of God, and that's a work that extends all the way down to the most fundamental levels of our bodies, or down to our cells. And so of all the things we'll talk about in this class, this kind of piece of transgenderism is one of the most extreme rebellions, is one of the ways we can think about it. So when God fearfully and wonderfully made us, when he knit us together in our mother's womb, when he made us male or female, down to the smallest level of our biological composition, but the transgender movement would suggest that God's authority all the way down to that lowest level can be overthrown, that our body parts can be exchanged, that our very personhood can be transformed. And so, like I said, if we're looking at it as a bullseye, transgender ideology is kind of the farthest thing we have from God's design of sex and sexuality. And so we're going to spend tonight really trying to just think through the transgender ideology, what they're arguing for, and then even what they're trying to suggest are the ways to treat a person who is wants to be transgender. But even before we get to that, let's start with one kind of topic, one phrase that we need to kind of lead with, and that's this idea of gender dysphoria. So it's kind of the second Roman numeral on your note sheet there. But gender dysphoria is one of the a term we used the very first night of the class as we were talking through kind of definitions of words. But when you think dysphoria is the opposite of euphoria, like euphoria being profound happiness. Well, dysphoria would be a profound unease. And gender dysphoria is when a person experiences a sense that their body does not match the gender that they feel themselves to be, right? So the gender they feel doesn't match the body that they inhabit. Or the definition you have on your note sheet was kind of the first definition that we gave way back on the very first note sheet. But gender dysphoria is a psychological distress that stems from a feeling of incongruence with one's biological sex. So it's kind of this idea of feeling trapped in the wrong body. So even as we hear that phrase, as Christians, we should not discount that as a category. Okay, because of all people, we should be a people who have a category for just how far the fall takes all people, right? So the fall has made us at war with God. And of course, it can make some people feel at war with their own bodies. So as a category, gender dysphoria, we shouldn't just like shirk that and think that's a ridiculous category. No, but biblically, we can understand, because we understand the depravity of human beings and the just how far the fall takes us, we should be able to resonate with this idea of gender dysphoria. So Sam Alberry, who I've quoted to you numerous different times, he points out that a concept like gender dysphoria should make sense to Christians because we are a people who understand how fallen people can feel in a fallen world. Okay, so he uses Romans 8, verses 20 and 21 to make this point. So I'm going to read Romans 8, 20 and 21, then I'm going to read the quote that comes from Sam Alberry. This is all kind of right there on your note sheet. But Romans 8 says this, "For creation, the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God." And then Alberry kind of explaining that passage, he says this, "Creation is not right. The physical world has been subjected to futility, to frustration. It does not work properly. It's out of joint, and it's been subjected to this frustration by God. The Bible's wider narrative explains this. God cursed the ground as a judgment on human sin, Genesis 3:17. In other words, the world isn't right, both as a consequence and as a demonstration of the fact that we're not right. What's true of creation in general is true of our bodies too. They're part of the physical order that's been subjected to this frustration. We see this frustration in a variety of ways. Some face unremitting health issues. Others contend with a whole range of body image struggles. Still, more experience body dysphoria, feeling as though they're trapped in the wrong kind of body. The fact is, virtually, no one has an entirely straightforward relationship with their own body. It's the way of life in this world. And while it's true that anyone can see this problem, Christians can uniquely account for it. Knowing these things should make us compassionate. While much of the thinking around transgender issues today is flawed, the pain experienced by those with gender dysphoria is all too real. We of all people should appreciate why, for we of all people understand the true depth of what is wrong with this world. And our churches should be places where people feel most safe trying to articulate their own sense of not being right." So I think there's a lot to that quote from Sam Alberry. But essentially, he's saying, as Christians, we cannot discount this, meaning I say this, gender dysphoria, as a real distress felt by real broken people in a broken world. But how we respond to gender dysphoria cannot be the same way that the world responds. So our response will be to point them back to God's true and unfaltering designs, whereas our modern culture's response would be to direct people toward an imaginary solution that actually results in the complete destruction of a person. And that's really what is happening when a person transitions, to use the term that's thrown around a lot, when a person transitions from male to female or vice versa. When they do that, they are completely destroying themselves. And for us as Christians, it's not loving to affirm that. It's not love to congratulate wholesale delusion. It's not love to congratulate gruesome self-mutilation. And ultimately, that's what the transgender movement is moving individuals toward. And so let's get into that. So the premise of the transgender argument, so Roman numeral 3 on your note sheet. Sharon James, it's in her short little book. It's called Gender Ideology, What Do Christians Need to Know? She lays out kind of 4 points succinctly that are the basic tenets of the transgender argument. If you're looking for one book to read on this subject, this is probably the one I'd recommend just because it's short, 126 pages, and not that difficult to read. But she has these 4 points. Binary is bad. Gender is a spectrum. Boy slash girl or man slash woman are just social constructs. And number 4, we all have a gender identity which may be different from our biological sex. So that's Sharon James kind of summarizing what's behind transgender ideology, okay? So let's spend some time on each of those. So the first argument is that binary is bad. So a key piece of the transgender ideology is that sex binary has to be rejected. They would say there has to be more options than male or female. So if gender can be changed, then what they're trying to do, they have to unhook gender from biological sex. And so to do that, one of their main arguments is that sex is something that is assigned at birth by a doctor or by a parent. So in an attempt to erase this binary, they argue that sex is not a fixed reality, but an assigned identity, okay? So science would tell us that biological sex is determined at conception, and Christians would say that it's determined by God at conception, but the transgender activists would say that sex is projected onto a person by some other person when they arrive in this world. So whether that's a doctor or a parent, and so they would, that's a key term we need to understand, that they would say sex is projected upon a person. It's not recognized, it's not, I see your body and I tell you're a male or a female, but they would say, no, they see that, then they say, oh, we're putting on you the label of male or female. So they're trying to argue that by changing how you think about biological sex, what they're trying to do is trying to undermine this sexual binary, okay? So they're trying to undermine male and female so that they can pave the way to differing genders, okay? So it's not just sex leads to gender, but sex is projected onto a person. And so we've got to separate this binary. There's not, the binary is bad. That's kind of their main overall point. So, which gets us to the second thing. So binary is bad. And then secondly, gender is a spectrum. And by this, they mean there's not just two genders, male or man and woman, but infinite genders, indefinite amount of genders. So if biological sex is not a binary, then we can have as many genders as we need to have. And it's here that we need to present the creation of what transgender activists know or have called the gender-bred person. And so, Jared, if you'll throw that up on the screen for us. I don't want to put this in your notes because I don't want like a kid to find it and be like, oh, great, look, this is fun, because this is not good. Okay, this is, just be clear as I can, this is very bad. It's kind of hard for you to see, but if you just were to Google the gender-bred person, this is version 3.3. There's more versions because they keep having to change it because they realize, oh, that's insensitive for us to say. We need to add something else to it. But I'll just kind of walk through it really quickly. So the gender-bred person is how you help someone identify what gender they actually are. Okay, so there's kind of 4 pieces to that. They start up there at the top where that little brain is. Okay, and so the first piece is gender identity. And by that, they mean how you in your own head, that's why it's the brain, how you in your own head define your gender, okay? And so then that's kind of plotted on a spectrum, the kind of the thing to the right there with the circle and the arrows. It's like the opposite of womanness and then all the way to the end of womanness. It's just, you're supposed to put like a mark that says, I'm somewhere in there. And same thing on the next one down. Am I the opposite of manness or am I closer to the line of manness, okay? So you start there with gender identity. It's who in my head I believe my gender to be, right? And then the next thing is kind of gender expression, which is the dotted line coming outside of the gingerbread man, okay? And gender expression is the way you present your chosen gender, right? So your actions, the way you look, the way you dress. And again, that's kind of on a spectrum of masculinity and femininity. And it does not have to correspond necessarily with the gender identity that you've chosen for yourself. You might put your point, you might put your X somewhere way close to womanness, but then you might express yourself way closer to masculinity. So those things don't necessarily have to go together. But so that's kind of the first part. You decide your identity. You decide, secondly, how you're going to express yourself. Then the third part is biological sex, by which they mean the physical sex characteristics you are born with and that you develop. And so that's kind of on the gingerbread man. No other way to say this, but the crotchular region there. And so your biological sex determines everything, including genitalia, body shape, voice, body hair, hormones, chromosomes. And I think it's important that we would notice that they put that third, not first. Okay? They put that as the third thing. You decide who you are in your mind first. And then the third piece is kind of more incidental rather than actually kind of the key piece of it all. So if you were to put that first, this whole transgender logic falls apart. And then the fourth thing they have is attraction. So that's a little heart there in the gingerbread man or gingerbread person, excuse me. So in this, they have two subcategories of attraction, meaning romantic attraction and sexual attraction. And so you could be attracted romantically to one type of person, but physically attracted to another type of person. But you, again, the goal is you kind of plot yourself somewhere on that spectrum for each one of these. And again, the combinations are seemingly infinite, which is why they talk about gender as a spectrum. Okay, Jared, you can get rid of that now. Thanks, man. So that's kind of point number two. Gender is a spectrum. The third piece of the transgender argument would be that boy and girl or man and woman are just social constructs. By that, what she means is there's nothing innate in you, right? You aren't a man or a woman by nature, but really by nurture, right? The only reason so many people fall into these historically masculine or historically feminine categories is because those are the categories that we have constructed, right? There's no natural progression of a person being born. I'm just going to say some words, okay? There's no natural progression of a person being born with a penis and thus becoming a man, okay? That's not a natural thing. That's just society has made that the case. That's what they argue, at least, okay? So they're just social constructs. There's no real hard reality to masculinity and femininity making you man or woman or certain gender. And then the fourth part, we all have a gender identity, which may be different from our biological sex. And so in light of all the deconstruction of sex and gender that's been done above, each person now just gets to determine who they are. Your body parts don't determine your gender. You do, right? And that's where kind of the contribution of the logic of Carl Truman's Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, which we quoted the very first night, we talked about kind of that concept of social imaginary, if you remember that. But his work is kind of helping us understand, like, how do we get to this point of I get to determine my authentic self? Nothing outside of me, no doctor, no social construct, not my own body parts, and certainly not some invisible God. Nobody can tell me who I am. I get to determine my authentic self. So that's kind of the fourth piece of the transgender argument. Now, as we think about the Christian response to that, my hope is that if you've been attending this class, you already know some of the initial ways you'd respond to some of these premises of the transgender argument. And so I'll try to do this quickly. So I'll just kind of have four rebuttals to those four points. So the first one, sexual binary is a non-negotiable materiality. Okay, so once again, we have to think back to Genesis 1 and 2. They are absolutely critical. So this isn't on your note sheet, but you've heard it so many times, you probably have it memorized. Genesis 1, 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Okay, so we've spent basically like kind of like three whole lectures just really driving that whole point home. We're not going to spend a ton more time here. But we need to notice that this binary is so foundational that it shows up on the very first page of Scripture. And it absolutely never goes away, right? Male and female, God creates everyone. And so if you want a little bit more on that, I'll tell you to go back to the second lecture and you can listen to more about kind of God's designs there. But even as I say that, one of the first moves that transgender activists would make would be to point to a third sex of individuals that are called intersex people. Okay, so intersex. And intersex is a category that we should reckon with. Okay, so if you follow the LGBTQIA plus acronym, I is intersex. Okay, and so a person is considered intersex who is born with ambiguous genitalia. Okay, so there are varying degrees of this, but even as we say it, even as we talk about it, we'll say this condition is exceedingly rare. So something about 1 in 5,000 births might produce a child that has some sort of disruption in their sexual development. Okay, and so that's maybe a better way to talk about intersex people, or people who've had some sort of disruption in their sexual development in utero, right? And so most often, a person's sex is clear through genetic testing, so you're able to tell if a child's male or female by examining things down to the chromosomal level. And in some cases, which are increasingly or even more rare, where it's difficult to discern the sex, and that way, the one of the best ways that you can start to discern what gender, what sex a child is to watch that child as it develops, especially into puberty, to know for certain. But all that to say, it's important to note that disorders of sexual development, things like intersex, does not equal a third sex, okay? That's not the way we should view intersex people. There's not a third thing that blows up the binary of God's created order. But instead, when we think about intersex as a category, or intersex situation, intersex people, those are people that have had some sort of developmental disorder that has occurred within the framework of a sexual binary. Okay, so intersex is a category. It's a variation within the binary of male and female. And we need to know that most intersex people are happy to embrace either a male or a female identity. Most intersex people are not necessarily looking to be labeled as a third type of person. They would prefer to fit into the binary. And so all that to say, this little kind of sidebar into intersex, it's meant to say that the presence of this scenario, the scenario of intersex individuals, is not a disruption to God's sexual binary. But it is, again, another evidence of the fall, even the fall kind of working itself into human development in utero. But it's interesting to note, just as we think about this idea of binary, it's interesting to note that the initial letters of that LGBT, binary is a critical non-negotiable point, right? So lesbians are attracted to women, not to a broad range of multiple genders, right? Same thing with homosexual men, right? They're attracted to men, not to a broad range of multitudinous genders, right? And even bisexuals, they get their label from this category of binary, right? They're attracted to both sides of the binary. They don't get rid of the binary, right? Only the transgender side of the argument seeks to get rid of the binary. And we need to know that that's not a possibility. That's not something that can be done. Second point of rebuttal. Gender is directly tied to sex. So contrary to the genderbread person, we would say gender is not a spectrum, right? So whereas the genderbread person suggests that gender identity, as you conceive of it, is the most foremost thing, and then flowing from that is your expression, and then your biological sex is somewhat incidental to all this, a biblical, theological anthropology starts with our distinct embodiment. So a biblical understanding of our humanity starts with an understanding of our body parts and our chromosomal makeup, right? So the point in all this is saying, foremost in the Bible's account of humanity is sex, which determines gender. And then that fixed sex or gender dictates how we ought to express that gender in ways that are natural and in accordance with creation. So what you should note in the Christian explanation of gender versus the transgender explanation is a fixed understanding of gender compared to a fluid understanding of gender. It's kind of under the Christian understanding, this fixed nature versus this fluid nature of gender. So according to the transgender argument, gender is fluid. It fluctuates, and they're completely okay with that. Like, it's okay that you one day are this gender and decide that this day you want to be this gender and this day you want to be a different gender. That's kind of part of the argument. Unless you were to fluctuate back to a gender it really just lined back up with basic binary distinctions of male and female. They wouldn't be as okay with you being fluid back to that point, right? At that point, most transgender activists would be less inclined to accept fluidity if you're just moving back to a binary, right? But they would argue for a more fixed understanding of identity, that you're fixed as a trans person, not that you've moved away from being trans back to the standard binary. But we call that a contradiction, by the way. But point number three. We'll move on to the third one. Third one. So man and woman are not social constructs, but they're complementary social realities that point to eternal realities. So they're not social constructs, but they're complementary social realities that God has designed to point to eternal realities. So in our second lecture, we talked about how God created sex primarily for his glory. And one of the main points that we made there was how God designed man and woman to unite together in sexual complementarity. And he did so in a way that was intended to illustrate the eventual union of Christ and his bride, God and his people. So if that point still stands, which it does, to say that manhood and womanhood are just inventions of human culture, that undercuts the eternal realities of the gospel, really the most important future elements of the gospel. Right? So the Bible is affirming and upholding these social realities, is not calling them social constructs. In other words, God created these distinct realities, not society, right? And since God created these realities, he gets to dictate how we're supposed to live in accordance with those realities, right? And so manhood, womanhood, they're not just social constructs, but things put in place by God, complementary social relations that are pointing to eternal realities. And God has specific ways that we're supposed to live to point to those realities and not to undermine those realities. So the Bible is very explicit about the rightness of men and women living in accordance with their biological sex. The Bible actually has a lot to say against presenting oneself in a way that's contrary to your nature. So in terms of the, if we're thinking about the genderbread person again, in terms of the expression side of the genderbread person, so kind of how they present themselves, the Bible actually prohibits a man expressing himself as a woman and vice versa, right? So Deuteronomy 22, verse 5, I actually put that one on your note sheet. But in the book of Deuteronomy, way back in the Old Testament, God says, a woman shall not wear a man's garment, nor shall a man put on a woman's cloak. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. And if you remember that word abomination, it's the same word that was used in the book of Leviticus for homosexual sin. So God is saying these realities are not socially constructed, right? They're pointing to bigger realities that I have put in place. And to try to present yourself as the opposite of what you are, God says, is an abomination. Right? So that's all the way back in the Old Testament. But in the New Testament, it reiterates some of the exact same principles. So you don't have to turn there necessarily, but maybe at some point in the future you can. But in 1 Corinthians 11, there's all this talk about hair length and head coverings, and that can be really kind of culturally confusing. Like, what are we supposed to take from all that? But the point of that teaching is that it's shameful. It's a shameful thing for men to present themselves as women and vice versa, okay? So what I hope you see that I'm saying is that these are not social constructs. Yes, we can agree and concede the point that masculinity and femininity have some different cultural aspects to it. Like what is considered manly in one culture or one era is going to be different in another culture and era. And so gender roles look different in different societies. And I'm happy to concede that point because I think that's entirely true. But the Bible forbids men to express themselves in feminine ways, in ways that contradict their biological sex. So the Bible is serious on this point precisely because these matters are not socially constructed. They're divinely constructed realities that are pointing to eternal realities. So we would disagree, we'd say that man and woman is not a social construct, but it's an eternal reality. Start in the garden, and we'll continue on into eternity. And the fourth thing, we can't let gender drive a wedge between body and identity. And so we have to look at the fruits of this kind of thinking. And so transgender ideology, what it does is it fragments a person and takes away any sort of bodily organization toward a functional future. Okay? The transgender ideology, it fragments a person, fragments their personhood, and takes away any sort of bodily organization that's going to move them toward some sort of functional future. So the Christian understanding of a person integrates the body and the person. So from your chromosomes to your sexual organs to your gender expression toward your sexual reproduction, it all has this orientation toward the same goal, which we can even just say, which is be fruitful and multiply, right? Can't remember if I brought this book up here. It doesn't look like I did. But the book that I quoted from, Abigail Favale, she's a Catholic author. But she talks about these kind of two different categories of a fragmented reality versus bodily integrity, right? So just think about the gingerbread person again, and like you could kind of plot all your marks on that thing. A person could be spread out all over the place, right? In terms of what their brain thinks, what their body says, what their heart says, what they look like, could be spread out all over the place, a fragmented reality. But the Christian understanding integrates the body, the self, the person, all of it together, right? And so we should be suspicious of how the transgender account of personhood is piecemeal. It's fractured. Nothing really fits together. Not only does it not fit together, but it makes it impossible for a person to be fruitful and multiply, right? Whereas the biblical account of personhood is coherent, functionally ordered toward a functional future of be fruitful and multiply. So that's kind of at least just four ways we would rebut the four points of the transgender ideology. But the next thing I want to do is think about the transgender ideology suggests treatment should go about. So if a person experiences gender dysphoria, what should they do about it? So according to the transgender belief, if a person's internal sense of their gender determines their sex, and then the treatment that they should receive is what they would call gender-affirming treatment, okay? So this would be treatment that takes their body and forces the body to affirm the gender that they feel themselves to be, okay? So that's kind of what gender-affirming treatment is. You're taking the body, trying to force the body into the feeling that you believe yourself to be. And there's really kind of four steps that the transgender argument would suggest. This is how you move forward with this gender-affirming treatment, or this is how you move forward. You might even use the phrase transitioning, okay? So this is what they would say. There's a social dynamic, a psychosocial, chemical, and physical. Okay, so the first part, social transition. So this is the first step, which involves a change in gender expression and changing your role in a way that corresponds with this supposed new identity. So this would be things like taking on a new wardrobe, a new name, new pronouns, and generally just being treated as a person of the opposite sex. So this kind of idea of social transition, this is essentially the text message you've gotten from a parent of one of your kids. Teammates that's on your sports, their kids' sport team or your sport club or your class, and it says, hey, just want to let you know, Rebecca is now going to be called Reggie, and we want you to respect that decision. That's kind of the social transition idea. So, and as we think about it, that first step really is likely going to be the lowest cost, right? This first step of social transition is kind of the way of testing out the transgender waters. But at the same time, as Christians, we should realize that while it's just the first step, it is a step in the direction of some drastic, completely life-altering treatment decisions. And so I think that's another reason why, for us as Christians, we should be hesitant to affirm the use of preferred pronouns, right? Because each step of affirmation pushes a person toward these irreversible decisions. And we'll think kind of more in detail with a little more nuance about the pronoun thing next week. But even that, I just think, like, as you look at these four steps, social transition to psychosocial treatment, to clinical treatment, to a physical treatment, meaning sex reassignment surgery, I think we want to be careful not to pat someone on the back in step one and send them down to step four. So that's, we'll think more about that, because I know there's a lot of nuance that goes with it. Every situation is different, but it's at least why I would say it would give me pause before I would say, let's use those pronouns. Okay. But after the social, or along with the social, comes some psychosocial treatment. So psychosocial treatment, this is essentially a step of psychotherapy recommended by a transgender activist that's aimed at mentally affirming someone in their decision to transition. So this therapy would be aimed at, and I'm going to quote from Ryan T. Anderson here, it's aimed at addressing the negative impact of stigma. This therapy is aimed at alleviating internalized transphobia. So internally, you're transphobic, and we need to work that out. This treatment, this therapy is aimed at enhancing social and peer support, improving body image, promoting resiliency, all these sort of things. So this is therapy that's meant to affirm the decision that's being made to transition, and then to work against any thoughts that would challenge that decision to transition. Okay, so there's this social piece. I'm kind of changing who I'm presenting myself to the world as. There's this kind of psychosocial piece. I'm going to therapy to help me really confirm what I'm trying to do here. And then third, there's this chemical treatment, which would be the administration of cross-sex hormones. So cross-sex hormone therapy is designed to either masculinize or feminize the body. And so a biological female would take testosterone to masculinize her body. And then a biological male would take estrogen to feminize his body. And of course, we need to understand this has massive effects, if not irreversible effects. So when a female takes testosterone, and for the next 2 points, I'm just going to get specific and even kind of graphic sometimes, but I'm not trying to be vulgar in any way. I'm just trying to be direct so that we understand what we're talking about here. And I think the more clear we are on it, the more able we are to say, this does not make sense, right? But when a female takes testosterone, she's going to begin to have a deepened voice, growth in facial hair and body hair. She's going to stop having her menstrual cycle. She's going to have atrophy of her breast tissue. She's going to have increased libido. I can never say that word right. Libido. And decreased percentage of body fat as compared to muscle mass. When a woman takes testosterone, it will make her physical appearance more masculine. But this appearance does not make her a man. Regardless of the amount of testosterone, though her breasts may be gone, though her capacity to breastfeed in the future will be gone, though she will never produce any more eggs and no longer have the capacity to conceive a child, she will never have the functional body parts or the cellular composition that will allow her to produce sperm. Regardless of how she disfigures her appearance, chemically, she cannot be a man. It's impossible. Likewise, if a male is taking estrogen, he'll start to grow breasts. He will have decreased libido, decreased testicle size, and an increased body fat compared to muscle mass. This man may have chemically grown breasts, but those breasts will never be capable of lactation. His genitals may shrink, but they will never form the capacity to develop and bring forth life. So all that to say, the chemical treatment is drastic, and it does bring physical changes that mimic the physical appearance of the opposite sex, but it is in appearance only. Biological composition, particularly biological composition with an orientation towards sexual reproduction, is not achievable in this kind of transition. But even still, that does not stop people from moving to the fourth step of the transition, which is the most drastic. And so that would be physical treatment or sex reassignment surgery. So this would be a surgery that permanently alters the primary or the secondary sex characteristics of a person. Again, this part is a little bit graphic, okay? So this would include the removal of parts. So for a female, a mastectomy, or for a male, a gonadectomy or a penectomy. Words you didn't think you would hear or had ever heard before. This would include the attempted recreation of new body parts through plastic surgery. So the artificial creation of a penis or vagina or breasts. Again, all of these are in appearance only. They're not functional. And in large part, they are dramatically unsuccessful. To put it bluntly, only God in heaven has the capacity to build fully functional genitalia. Plastic surgeons cannot do it. And what I want to point out here, along with the impossibility of this treatment, is the sheer brutality of it. I didn't put this quote on your note sheet, but I'm going to read a person who is kind of writing on the backside of all the health problems and complications they had after walking through gender transition. And so it's a female who tried to transition to male. But she says this: during my own transition, I had 7 surgeries. I had a massive pulmonary embolism, a helicopter life flight ride, an emergency ambulance ride, a stress-induced heart attack, sepsis, a 17-month reoccurring infection due to using the wrong skin during a failed phalloplasty, 16 rounds of antibiotics, 3 weeks of daily IV antibiotics, the loss of all my hair, only partially successful arm reconstructive surgery, permanent lung and heart damage, a cut bladder, insomnia-induced hallucinations, oh, and the frequent loss of consciousness due to pain from the hair on the inside of my urethra. All of this led to a PTSD that made me a prisoner in my apartment for a year. Between me and my insurance company, medical expenses exceeded $900,000. And that is what is recommended. To solve the problem of gender dysphoria, the recommended treatment by trans activists, by many doctors, is to force the fixed body into agreement with a person's fluid understanding of their own gender identity. And we walk through all of that so that we will see we do not want to be complicit in this. As we stare at the facts of this ideology in the face, if we look at this ideology all the way through, we cannot help but come to the conclusion that it is not loving to affirm this. It is not love to push someone this far from God's designs for their life. It is not love to push someone to this level of self-harm. It's not love to affirm delusion. And what has sickened us more than anything is the way that this playbook is virtually the exact same for children. So should a child or a teenager whose brain is not fully developed, who's not capable of the critical thinking skills to envision their future and all that would be lost in this kind of transition, if a child or a teenager insists that they are a boy trapped in a girl's body, then the transgender ideology would tell them to follow the exact same playbook. They would say, if there's a child that identifies as the opposite sex in a manner that's consistent, persistent, and insistent, then gender-affirming care is the way to go. So that means as soon as possible, they would encourage a social transition. So new wardrobe, new name, new pronouns, all that. And then depending on their age, they would recommend trying to delay puberty by prescribing puberty blockers. So rather than letting puberty play out and let children grow into more sexually mature individuals, they would recommend stopping puberty, delaying puberty. And the truth is, puberty is actually one of the best ways for a gender dysphoric child to deal with that dysphoria. The vast majority of times, puberty is the thing that undoes the dysphoria. And we should understand that makes sense, right? But the transgender treatment is for gender dysphoric kids to delay puberty so that it's easier to introduce cross-sex hormones when they're closer to the appropriate age. And so around age 16, they would prescribe cross-sex hormones. And so they would try to mimic the process of puberty from the opposite sex. So a 16-year-old girl has been put on puberty blockers. She would start taking testosterone, and then she would try to force her body into what looks like male puberty. And then finally, at age 18, they would recommend sex reassignment surgery. So the removal of sexually functional body parts, assuming they're still functional after all the hormones, and then a plastic surgery or multiple plastic surgeries to create the appearance of the opposite sex body parts. Now, can you imagine your 18-year-old self being mature enough to think down the road of your future life to the point that you would feel responsible enough to make these kinds of decisions, decisions that would change your entire relational, reproductive, and bodily future. It's pure insanity. And it is child abuse. But this is the treatment that's prescribed by doctors, gender clinics, therapists, and more who subscribe to this transgender playbook. But the question that Christians should be asking is kind of the fifth part there on, sorry, the sixth part there on the note sheet. The question we should be asking is, if someone is experiencing gender dysphoria, should treatment bring the body in line with the mind or the mind in line with the body? Which of these is more attainable, to make the body fit the mind or the mind fit the body? You have a long quote on your note sheet. It comes from Ryan Anderson's book. It's called When Harry Became Sally. But Ryan Anderson, he's going to quote a couple different like scientists and stuff in this quote. But what he's going to do with this is compare treating gender dysphoria to other types of dysphorias that people commonly experience. And so the one he brings out is, for instance, anorexia. And so I'm just going to read the quote, and you can kind of read along with me. But I think some of the things he says in here help make sense of this question. Are we trying to bring the body in line with the mind, or should we bring the mind in line with the body? But he says this: many psychologists and psychiatrists think of gender dysphoria as similar to other dysphorias, forms of profound discomfort with one's own body. The feelings of discomfort can lead to mistaken beliefs about oneself or about reality, and then to actions in accordance with those false beliefs. So Dr. McHugh says that people who identify as transgender suffer a disorder of assumption like those in other disorders familiar to psychologists. The disordered assumption of those who identify as the opposite sex, he says, is similar to the faulty assumption of those who suffer from anorexia nervosa, who believe themselves to be overweight when in fact they are dangerously thin. Dr. Josephson, and as he's quoting all these people, he's like been interacting with some of their studies, and so you're kind of just catching a quote with all these random names in it, so sorry about that. But Dr. Josephson describes this phenomenon as a delusion, in which psychiatry refers to as a fixed false belief which is held despite clear evidence to the contrary. So a delusion is a fixed false belief which is held despite clear evidence to the contrary. And he too draws a parallel to the beliefs involved in anorexia and the belief that one is the opposite sex, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Someone who becomes subject to a delusion or disordered assumption may at first be aware of harboring feelings that are not in line with reality. But over time, those feelings generate an alternative reality in their own minds. Some people with anorexia, for instance, may initially feel overweight, but know they're not. And so they struggle with their mistaken feelings until the feelings overwhelm them and they come to believe that they are actually fat, and this belief governs their actions. Likewise, some people with gender dysphoria feel as if they were the opposite sex, but know they're not. And so they struggle with their feelings until their feelings overwhelm them and they come to identify as the opposite sex and act accordingly. Granted, there are significant differences among these. Yet, the similarities suggest that the most effective approach for treating gender dysphoria may be similar to the treatment of other dysphorias. In all cases, the starting point is to recognize that feelings are not the same as reality. Psychiatrists must obviously challenge the concept that what is in the mind cannot be questioned, because it needs to be, right? Says, that's what McHugh says. Mental health professionals must not simply help people survive with whatever beliefs they happen to hold, but help people to accept the truth as they work through the deeper issues beneath their false beliefs. It's vital to help people accept reality, says Cretella, when their false beliefs are not merely emotionally distressing, but also life-threatening. So it's vital to help people accept reality when those false beliefs are not only just emotionally distressing, but they're also life-threatening. And so we read all that to show that the Christian response, and really even the scientific response, to someone with gender dysphoria cannot be to take these drastic measures to bring the body in line with the mind, especially if the mind is out of step with reality. Instead, treatment should be to bring the mind in line with reality. And now, culturally, this is referred to negatively as conversion therapy. Okay, and it would be deemed unethical by many activists and many professional organizations. And I just want to be clear on this. You will hear, especially in the news, the term conversion therapy used in a pejorative way. But as Christians, we cannot get on board with gender-affirming treatment. We can't get on board with something that's going to ruin people's lives. And so even if it's considered bigoted to push someone toward conversion therapy, that is bringing the mind in line with the body instead of bringing the body in line with the mind, we instead would push for conversion therapy. We may not call it that, but we would say the goal is for you to bring your mind in line with reality, not to bring your body in line with your mind, which is not in line with reality, right? We should alter the thinking. And that's going to kind of just serve as the segue into the next lecture. Okay, and so the first, this whole night was just going to say, what is transgenderism arguing for, and what are they arguing that we should do? And then the next lecture will be more of like us trying to think through, where is this coming from? Who are we up against? What are we up against? And when I say who are we up against, I'll just go ahead and lay my cards on the table. We are not up against people who have gender dysphoria. Those are the people we should care about and love. But the people who are trying to encourage them towards transitioning, trying to encourage them toward making these decisions that will change the rest of your life, their life, those are the people that we're actually against. So we'd say we were against the activists, but we're for the people experiencing the dysphoria in themselves. But we're going to think through all those things. So where is all this coming from? Who are we up against? What are we up against? Who is on our side? What is on our side? And what boundaries should we refuse to concede as we try to engage on this subject? It's 6:31. I'm going to pray, and you can come and talk to me afterward. Thanks, everybody.